I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. In October of 1985, a woman named Cherie Warren left work at a busy Salt Lake City office
to meet her estranged husband at a downtown auto dealership.
She never made it home. Cherie's car surfaced weeks later in Las Vegas.
In the parking lot of a hotel casino.
No one knows how it got there.
Strange. It was strange.
Both Cherie's estranged husband and her boyfriend raised suspicion for investigators.
I kind of thought that he might have done something.
But no arrests were ever made. In Cold Season 3, we dig into double lives, make new connections in the case, and examine the difficulty raised by reasonable doubt.
We want answers just as much as anyone else.
They have creeps like that now too, so nothing's changed.
That's the new Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie. Now available anywhere you get your podcasts.
In today's episode of Project Recovery...
In my home, emotional dishonesty is having feelings, but never talk about them.
I could see the boys kind of isolating with particular friends. There was a lot of red flags.
Make sure you listen to the end. Find us on Facebook at Project Recovery. We'll have that and much more coming up. Welcome to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction. More importantly, it's about recovery. It's brought to you by our friends at useonlyasdirected.org. They got a three-part solution for the opioid epidemic. It's speak out, opt out, and of course, throw out. But Dr. Matt, they've also got a new one coming out, and that is?
I'm liking Know Your Script. That's yep. Their new... what would you call it?
Campaign.
There you go. It's their new campaign.
And it has a double meaning.
It does, yeah.
And the first meaning is...
Well, know your prescription, the script, the know what pills you're taking, be an advocate for your own health care.
And the second part?
Is have a script when you go in and talk to your doctor.
Or your kids.
It. Or your kids or your family. Talk about how to dispose of the medications properly when you don't need them anymore. Talk about what's a safe way to use the medications you're being prescribed. Ask your doctor questions. Ask if there are alternatives to opioids, all those things.
And, you know, that's what this podcast is all about, is an education. Because I think in recovery, that's really the most important thing, is that we all get an education. Sometimes we think just the addict needs education, needs to figure out what they're going through. But it's a family disease.
Yeah, it affects everybody. And if everybody isn't on board and understanding what's going on, we're going to have problems.
All right, Dr. Matt, so I've got to talk to you about something, and this has happened to me this weekend, and it's been rattling around in my brain for a little while, and this comes on the heels of me having my first trials with alcohol since my recovery, and that being a 15-minute conversation with myself in front of the medicine cabinet whether or not I should take NyQuil to get a better night's sleep.
Right.
Now, we all know that I didn't. I decided it wasn't worth it not to even let it into my life.
Could you record that next time, like get a video of that, maybe pull the phone at that 15-minute self-conversation. I think we could use it on our social.
You know what? Throughout my whole recovery, even in my addiction, I had a lot of conversations with myself. I used to tell you all the time, when I was trying to stop drinking, I would look in the mirror, and I would the mirror would talk back, and I'd go, hey, we're not going to drink today. And the mirror would be like, yeah, we're not going to drink today. And I was like, so we're both on the same plan. And they're like, yes. And then 2 hours later, I'm on the back deck with a beer in my hand. I'm like, one of us is a liar. We both agreed to it, and I am drinking.
I can't trust that mirror.
You know? And so... But what I was doing, I was DJing a wedding Friday night for one member of our community here on Project Recovery. Her son was getting married.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And so I was DJing their wedding. And her husband, great guy, has 2 years of sobriety in there. And so we were talking in between the YMCA and the Labata, which is the forbidden dance.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. And so they were doing social distancing. They had masks on. The takeaway parting gift for the wedding was some hand sanitizer. Yeah.
Nice.
It said spread love, not disease. And I thought that was pretty cool.
I like it.
But so she asked me about my girlfriend. She goes, does your girlfriend drink? And I said, yeah, my girlfriend does. Although I've been with her for 2 years, I think maybe five times I've seen her drink. And maybe once been a little intoxicated.
So she rarely drinks.
And
not to excess.
Yeah. And she goes, does she have alcohol in her home? And I said, yes, she does. And she goes, well, I don't have it in mine. And then the husband gave me this kind of look. And I was like, why don't you have it in there? And she goes, well, I don't want him to be tempted. Mm-hmm. And that got me thinking and then we had an open conversation about this. And I go, do you really think he's not drinking because there's alcohol in the home, or do you think he's not drinking because he doesn't want to? Because we started talking. He's like, I told her she could have it in there, but she doesn't want to. I said, it's your choice. If I didn't want to have alcohol in the house, Leslie wouldn't have it in there.
But it's
her house.
Right.
And so I let her make her mind up, and I'm okay with her. The reason I'm not drinking is not because it's not in the house.
Right.
I spend 90% of the day by myself, and my picture's not hanging up in a Maverick. My picture's not in front of a bar. It's not, you know what I mean? The reason I'm not drinking is not because I don't have access to it.
Right. Oh, you could have access, sure.
The reason I'm not drinking is because I don't want to drink.
You've made that commitment.
I know where this – I played the tape 24 hours ahead. I know where this ends. And I'm 2 years plus some change in sobriety.
Right.
And it's taken me this long to figure this out. And there was a switch that was like, okay, I'm not drinking because I can't. I'm not drinking because I don't want to. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that, you know, when we talk about those stages of behavior change, you're in the commitment and maintenance phases, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you've gotten to a point where you've had 2 years, and time is only so as far as helpful. I mean, a lot of people go many years and then have relapses, but the more important thing is the personal feeling of commitment. But let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Don't you think, though, that for some people, having that alcohol in the house might be a dangerous temptation if they're not quite to that level of behavior change yet?
I'm glad you asked that, because that brings me to my point. My recovery is my recovery.
There you go.
And what I'm doing works for me. And when I look at them and their situation, that works for them. And if it makes her happy and he's okay with it, great.
Because it is a family disease. And frankly, her feelings need to be considered as well, because she was part of that alcohol abuse that was happening in the home, even though she wasn't the addict.
Yeah, because it is a family disease. And so I think that's what, you know, I want to just stress on this podcast that, you know, when I tell my stories, they're my stories. And it's my recovery, and it's what's working for me. And hopefully you can find some hope, some glimmer of
inspiration, maybe?
Yes, yeah. that it is possible. But you do have to find what works for you and what makes sense for you.
So in some households, it might just be, yeah, we don't keep any alcohol in the house. It's just too tempting. And maybe that's what works for them, because you know, people have different moments of weakness in anything, like if you're trying to change your diet or whatever it happens to be. And often it's kind of when you're late at night and you're tired. That's a weak time for human beings in our resolve when we're trying to make behavior change. So maybe if you're out and about during the day, it's easy to resist stopping into a bar or going to the Maverick and getting your Bud Light or whatever it is. But maybe late at night when you're tired and, you know, so maybe it's better for some people not to have it in the house.
All of a sudden 2020 smacks you in the face like so many it has already,
right?
You know, because it has. I mean, right now, 2020 has been a perfect storm for addiction. I mean, so many bad things have happened.
Isolation, depression, stress, financial problems, all those things that highly load on the addiction potential scale.
And so much the fact that, you know, in your own private practice, you've seen an increase.
Sure.
And, you know, we've had a lot of people reach out. We did last week's episode on finding a therapist and finding a good therapist, the one that's going to work for you.
Uh-huh.
But that's easier said than done.
It is. It's a process. Yeah. And people, you know, like we encourage people to do, please do it, and realize that, the video chat therapy sessions, research is showing that they're effective. So don't make that your excuse not to do it. But sometimes it can be tough, and you may need to reach out and get a referral.
All right. Well, I'm excited for our guest today. They are the owners of the Renaissance Ranch. We've got Christy and Rick Dixon. How are you guys?
We're doing great.
Doing great.
Thanks so much, Casey.
No, thank you guys very much. And as we were walking in, Christy, you were telling me that you guys are just overwhelmed right now with trying to help the community out.
Yeah, truly. We're so excited because we've got 5 weekly family classes. Starting next week, we're adding our 5th women's only family education class. So it's exciting. And yeah, we are. We've never had this many family members ever in the history of our company. I think last month I totaled in our family attendance 399.
Why do you think it's
people.
Up?
Oh, I'm sure with the COVID and everything, people are isolated. I think that we need that connection. As human beings, we all need that so badly.
But
with addiction.
Let's find out a little more about your story, because as I understand it, you and your husband are not addicts.
That's correct. Well, of a substance, that's for sure. Yeah. Codependency, I feel like, is a internal addiction that's unseen. And I think it's – I've been told by a lot of therapists that sometimes it's harder to cure codependency than it is, you know, a chemical addiction.
Well, let's find out from the beginning. Where did you guys grow up? A little bit about yourself. And then we'll get to the story.
Cool. Okay. Who wants to go first?
Why don't you go ahead, huh?
Okay.
So let me start. Okay. So I met Christy at BYU and just excited to get to know her. She was a cheerleader at BYU and
Matt played football for BYU. Just,
there we go.
Well,
there
played
we go.
Is an overstatement.
He wore a BYU jersey. He was on the team.
There we go. So it was fun because it was the year that Steve Young was there playing. And so great memories. And we had our life planned. We were married. We're LDS. So we was married, sealed in the temple, and started having kids and just knew that our life was going to be great. We found very quickly that our dreams are not always our kids' dreams. And we end up having five kids. Our two older boys at age 19 and 21 became addicted. And we knew something was going on prior, but we didn't know exactly what it was. Finally, it got so bad and it came out that they were both addicted to heroin. And that's when some real struggles started happening with our relationship with them, the relationship that Christy and I had. We always had a great marriage, but this took it absolutely to the brink.
Let's pass the mic over to Christy real quick, because I had the pleasure of going to lunch with you guys a couple weeks ago, and you said something that was interesting to me is that, you know, for the longest time in your marriage, you guys were on the same side, but when the addiction reared its ugly head with both of your sons, it really caused some turmoil between you two.
Oh, for sure. Oh, for sure. It's really, truly been the hardest thing I think I've ever, you know, up to this point in my life that I've had to go through. Yeah, for sure.
What was it causing the rift between you two?
Well, I think men and women handle their responses to addiction a little bit differently. I was definitely more the helicopter mom, the enabler, and very, very in the trenches with the boys. He was working, providing for the family. He was more of the tough love, rigid, pretty rigid. And he was trying to motivate them with using a lot of shaming, which we've learned that shame is kind of that core center that drives that cycle of addiction. And for me, I was blown away. Like, I had no experience with addiction. I didn't know what to do. I remember having a feeling one day to reach out to this couple in our church that were missionaries in the addiction recovery program, you know, that they had. And I was told to go. The only advice that we've ever been given was go to a meeting and you guys will get together on the same page, you know. So I remember having thoughts actually before that time that my marriage probably may not work if my husband wasn't willing to do everything possible to help my sons, because my heart was just so broken. I was just devastated. And I remember my mind just being obsessing constantly of how to fix the unfixable. You know, I didn't know at the time that it was a disease. You know, I thought at the time that it was just a matter of choice and that they could just stop. And I thought it was my job as a mom. You know, I really did. I was just racking my brains. Just, it was like mental fever, just trying to think how to fix them, I remember calling around trying to get all this information. And so we decided to start going to this 12-step meeting. And in that very first meeting, the spirit was so powerful. I didn't expect that. I didn't. I saw people actually smiling and happy, and I was blown away because I had been given some false information. I was told, you know, number one, they could die, which was so crazy. It's a life-threatening, as we know now, it's a life-threatening disease. But they could die, or they could end up in jail, you know, the rest of their life. Or they could, I can't remember what the third one was. But anyway, it was, you know, devastating for me. So as we go to this meeting and people are smiling and happy, I started to feel a sense of hope. I think that listening to the stories from the other addicts in the room, it really softened my heart. I was kind of in a place of judgment, you know, and a lot of frustration and fear was my biggest thing for sure. Super, super fearful. But I remember we went home and started telling our sons stories, sharing with them stories that we were hearing. And I think for the first time, they actually felt safe to come to us and tell us, you know, where they were really at, what was really happening. And I'll never forget the night that they told us that they were addicted to heroin. And they had a plan. They wanted to go to this, like, clinic and get on, like, Suboxone or something, methadone or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I remember my stomach just starting, just shaking really, really bad. After they went to bed that night, I went in and just started researching as much as I could about addiction and treatment. And I remember going to this website by my church, and it said something about the rock bottom is a myth, that addiction is a brain disease, and it's like any other disease. As soon as people start to address it, then the sooner healing can begin. And I think that snapped me out of some denial. I had a lot of coping mechanisms where I was thinking, well, they're just being boys. I mean, before this moment in time,
mm-hmm.
they're just being boys. They'll grow out of it. It's probably not that bad. Just a lot of rationalization, justification. And boy, when they told us that, I had something inside of me say, I have to take this really serious.
So you did what most moms most parents would do, but your job as a mother was to take care and make sure that they were all right. And you were doing the best you could with what you knew and you could do, right?
Right. And we had five kids, and they were our first, you know, our oldest two.
Uh-huh.
And they were best friends, and they were using together. So it was tricky. It was like I said, it was scary. I really feel like I fell into this cycle of just constant obsessing, couldn't sleep at night. If I woke up, I couldn't go back to sleep. Just so much fear, horribilizing what's going to happen. I mean, it just felt like they were walking towards a cliff and, you know, they were going to fall to their death, and I couldn't stop it.
Now,
it was making me crazy.
Let's swing the mic over to Rick.
Yeah.
And Rick, what was running through your head when all this was happening?
Well, you know, when you have kids in addiction, parents a lot of times will treat that situation differently, and it causes a great rift to the point that sometimes it will break up the marriage, and that's about where we are. So let me kind of put some meat on that bone. What was going on is that Christy loved those boys, loved the kids. She was a stay-at-home mom. She was dedicated to that end. And as the boys begin having issues and problems, as she mentioned, she enabled, and she didn't know that, meaning that it made it easier to use. Enabling makes addiction easier for the addict.
Because there's no boundaries.
Right. And there wasn't boundaries, and they were living in our home, and I didn't understand the word enable. All I knew is I could see that they were playing her and hence playing me. And I'm an A personality. So an A personality, they don't want to be taken advantage of. And I could see us being taken advantage of. I could see problems, and I could see relational issues. They were stealing, you know, from us. They were pawning things, stealing money from their siblings. And it got to the point to where, I was looking at this with tough love and boundaries, but what was happening is I was shaming, which we later learned that shame is the core center of all addiction. And you can shame in your very actions. You can shame in your words. But I was doing that in the way that I thought would motivate him. Boy, Dixons don't do this. What are you thinking? You're going to keep doing that? You're going to live under the bridge? You know, things like that. And what happens when a person is in addiction, we've learned, is that shame, it's emotional bleeding, and cravings always, always come from emotional bleeding. And the problem is with Christy, I would see these things happening, and I would see no consequences. And so I was at one point, and I'm really embarrassed to say this, but one point it got so bad that I says to my wonderful wife, I says, either you're out of the home or the boys are out. You take your pick. And that's not where we should have been as a couple. In addiction, it tears apart because of codependency. We were both codependent, but codependency is like an octopus. There's many different tentacles, and one might be shaming like me, but one might be enabling like Christy, and they fight each other. And of course, the addicts see that and they play against that. It becomes very difficult. That's one of the key reasons why we believe that the best thing that family members can do is to work on their own recovery, not recovery from drugs or alcohol. The addicts are doing that, but recovery from the emotional issues, the fear, the trauma, the resentments, the enabling, all these things that are tearing at their relationship and at their marriage.
We're going to find...
You feel like such a loss. Like you just don't know what to do. It's chaotic. You feel all this negative emotion, but you really don't have the tools to really know how to deal with that, how to manage that.
You're listening to Project Recovery. We're talking to Christy and Rick Dixon, and we're going to find out more about what they're doing when they found out their two oldest sons were addicted to heroin.
It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLPodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
So we're back with Christy and Rick Dixon, and we're talking about...
I want to jump in.
Can we jump in?
Yes. They've been doing a great job telling us, and I appreciate their description of the marriage. One of the terms used for what you were describing is called splitting, where the children or the child who's an addict will split the two parents in their styles when they're different, and then often, at least initially, the parents become more extreme in their styles. One parent becomes more rigid and one parent becomes more lenient, and so over time that splitting actually creates a bigger distance between the parents. But I think I'm curious, and I think the listeners are curious, like, how did this begin for your boys? Like we're talking about two boys, 19 and 20, from a conservative, religious, LDS household. So we know that addiction is not a respecter of any persons. But I think there's some curiosity. How did we get to heroin? Because it often starts with something else. Heroin isn't usually the gateway drug. How did we get to heroin with the boys?
You know, the boys started with a little marijuana. A little drinking, things
probably
like that.
Through their high school years.
Yeah, some pills, and it progressed. But what's interesting is that what we learned as we went to family classes and therapy is very interesting, and it's this, is that emotional dishonest families is fertile ground for addiction to really take effect.
That's very, very true.
And what I could not, I didn't buy it was my problem at first. I thought, these kids are the boys are the ones that are using. They need to get a handle on this, not me. But what I found, yes, an addict, as family and parents, we can't control it. We didn't cause it. But what I learned is we can definitely contribute to it.
Tell the listeners what emotional dishonesty is, and maybe can you give an example from your family?
Yeah. So do you want to share something on that?
Yeah, I do. I think Rick was, he was trying to motivate them, but he was pretty tough love, rigid.
Right.
And I could see the boys, I knew for years that they were not happy. I could tell, as a mom, I could tell. I mean, they'd go to church, their heads were down, they're burying their heads in their hands, and they stopped coming.
Did they withdraw from school and those sorts of activities?
They somewhat. Yes, they did. Yeah. And they were both great athletes. I mean, incredible athletes. Yeah. A lot of withdrawing, kind of isolating with particular friends. So, yes, there was a lot of red flags, big time. And like I said, I think I was in denial for a long time.
And so the emotional dishonesty, was that the way I understand that is that that is often a style that a family has. Irregardless, many families have an emotionally dishonest style, and there isn't addiction in the household. It's just a style of maladaptive communication. Is that the way, is that what you're talking about?
Well, and for me, it was like survival because he was so tough love. And as a codependent, I'm watching my sons, you know, struggle, and I'm seeing that relationship falling apart. So I'm trying to keep the peace. So in order to keep the peace and bring everything back to that homeostasis or that balance, right, and keep that everything nice and hunky-dory, I was just trying to be nice and kind of just, you know.
So not addressing real problems.
Right, exactly.
That's emotional dishonesty, not being able, not feeling, you know, the kids growing up in an environment where they don't feel free to have a dialogue, talk about how they feel because they're worried about repercussions or judgments. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Right. And, you know, you go back to addiction. What is it? Well, it's a feelings disease. The reason why, as addicts, we want to use is to numb out our feelings through the drug of choice we choose. And in my home, when I grew up, it wasn't okay to feel. You know, be tough, be a man.
Rub some dirt on it.
Don't tell me about
it.
My grandpa was an
alcoholic. That was going to be my next question. Do we have a history?
Yeah. So either family, I never heard my dad or my stepdad share feelings.
Right.
Never talked about.
And that generation of parents rarely did.
And it wasn't okay to talk about feelings.
Yeah.
And so, see, in my home, emotional dishonesty is having feelings but never talk about them.
Right.
And it wasn't okay to talk about them. And I'll give you an example of what happened once. One of our boys one time, you know, he'd been doing some bad things and we grounded him. That night he snuck out. Well, we caught him, you know, because his footprints were on the windowsill. And boy, I was bent out of shape, as any dad would be, right? And the next morning, I'm still mad. And as a dad, I want to show him that I'm mad. And I'm in the kitchen, and he comes in the kitchen. How can I explain this? We're in the same room, but emotionally, we are Grand Canyons apart. My body language is I'm not facing him. He's there, but I'm not talking to him because, see, I'm going to show him, right? I'm going to show him. That I'm mad. I'm emotionally distant. I'm grinning a little bit. And that's being emotionally dishonest. That's not sharing honestly and sitting down and saying, son, let's work through this.
I know you snuck out last night. I saw the footprint on the thing. Let's talk about this.
Right.
Even taking it one step further and saying, I feel really angry and betrayed that you snuck out last night. So that would be emotional honesty, right? Being able to express it. But since you grew up in a household with never having that be modeled to you, it makes sense that we repeat a lot of those problems in our own parenting. These sorts of things like emotional dishonesty, those are a generational problem, right? It's passed along from generation
to
generation.
And see, what we learned is if people have feelings and they can't share them, they will bury him, but they many times later will come out in the form of addiction.
Sure,
that's why we've heard many
psychopathology,
times.
Yeah,
you know where a person takes a drink or takes a pill, and all of a sudden they feel better than they ever could before because it numbs that shame and the feelings of the issues that they've got buried down.
You don't know how many times we've had people on this podcast that whether it be an opioid, marijuana, alcohol, that they said the first time they took it, they felt like themselves.
Yeah. Is that genetic predisposition, you think?
Well, that plus just the effect of a drug on anybody. Like those drugs are all designed to change your emotional status and how you feel. And so it's a relief. An opioid is a numbing agent in a way. So, but I think what you're talking about is for anybody, they have somewhat of that effect. You know, smoking weed or drinking makes everybody feel kind of relaxed and detached and calm. But the difference is if you've got all that stuff built up inside that you've been holding back every day and you have all that what we call psychic tension about it, holding that shame in, and you let that out, oh boy, that's a real treat to be able to be free from that for a few minutes. And so that if you have a biological or genetic predisposition, and that might hook you more strongly and more quickly than somebody who doesn't.
You know, what comes to mind as well is that when you have addicts in your life and say you're parents, What happens is it's so traumatic to the family members that it's hard for anybody to understand it. So we felt totally alone. How could anybody understand what we're going through? I'll never forget the one time. I mean, one of our sons was in jail 13 times. And I'll never forget one time we're walking in to visit him. They come in. They've got him because of the fence. They got him behind the glass. He comes in and he's got chains on his wrist, his feet coming up to his wrist and around his waist. And he's in this orange jumpsuit. And he should be 185, 190 pounds. He's a football player. But this is a couple years or a year after high school. And he's maybe 130 pounds.
Oh, wow.
I mean, how can you explain how we felt and what we saw, the shame, the fear of, is he going to ever get out of this? And so what happens? Yes, the addict, we learn, has to work through a lot of stuff and he or she needs to go to treatment. But what we found is that the family member is just as affected, sometimes even more, and they need treatment, if you will, as well. Not treatment from chemical drugs, but they need to be able to know how to deal with emotional dishonesty, know how to deal with fear. I remember going to bed one night after getting up, going to the bathroom, and Christy had not slept. And it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and I can almost hear her heartbeat, and she is emotionally bankrupt. See, that's what I'm talking about. So the point is, when an addict needs help and goes in to get help, that's great. But if the family members don't get help, it can be very problematic. In fact, there's stats that show that if a family member of the addict gets into recovery as well, the addict has a 78% higher chance of recovery. Why? Because now the family members work through their feelings issues. They've worked through maybe the anger, the resentment, the fear, the enabling. They've learned how to do boundaries, the things that make relationships work better. And, I guess a real point in how important it is for the family member to get to recovery. Remember we mentioned that shame is a core center of addiction, and that a family member can drive that shame. Well, this is a true story. There was two boys, not our family. This is later on, two boys that were using together. One went into treatment and one didn't. The older went into treatment. The younger one did not. The dad decides, hey, he needs to go get fixed. It's not my problem. And the father comes to pick him up at the center after he's done, and he still has this venom, this anger, this resentment, and with animosity in his face. Before they even get in the car, he says to his son that he's picking up that just went through recovery. He says, "Now look, I spent a ton of my own money on you, of our retirement. Great that you've now got this under wraps, but you need to go out and fix your brother. He's out running and gunning. You need to go solve the problem, and you need to make sure he doesn't use anymore." Mm. Now, see, you can feel the anger, the resentment, the animosity, and of course, the shame that's heaped upon that son. And again, shame is emotional bleeding that causes, a person just to want to go out and its cravings and go use. That within a short period of time, that older brother went and used again. What would have happened, though, if that father would have gone into recovery and he would have worked the steps like we
not
learned
to? Just coming to the treatment center.
Just coming to the
educated on,
right.
Yeah, and would have had worked through his feelings, and would have come out and said something like this to his son: "Son, I am so grateful. I honor that you fought this battle. What I've learned is that addiction is a brain disease, and it is a difficult thing to handle. Thank you for doing this, and I've learned that I have to work through some things, and I'm working on my recovery, and I know you have and will continue. And hopefully together, your younger brother can see and have hope and feel that there's some hope in your recovery, and we can work and help him together. See the difference?
Yeah, it's amazing. I want to get back to the story just a little bit here. You know, the last time you guys were talking about your story a little bit is that you said either the boys leave or you leave, you decide. And it seems like nobody left.
Right. So, yeah, thank you so much, because I was thinking about going back to that too. So that's about the time that we went to our first recovery meeting, a 12-step meeting, you know, right?
Mm-hmm.
And really, truly, it was a miracle. Like all of a sudden, all those secrets, all the feeling stuff that we could not talk about, here these people in the room, you know, all these sweet people recovering from addiction were so vulnerable. And as you know, if you've been to a 12-step meeting, I mean, they are completely authentic and raw and 100% honest. Like you feel it in your bones. So it started to give us some hope. And I really feel like that's when our family started to enter the recovery phase, because now we're going home and we're sharing with our boys. I never thought they would come with us to a meeting, but I think they're starting to feel safe, right? And they actually came with us to the 12-step meetings. They started coming. At first, they were sleeping through the whole meeting because they were still struggling, you know, with their addiction.
Oh, I've slept through a couple.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
That's why they serve coffee.
Yeah.
But it was so beautiful because now, like Rick, I'm so glad he brought up the disease aspect, because we didn't understand the disease. So I feel like that was the most important piece of information for us to learn, was that this is a brain disease.
And at that point, was it the first time your sons had been to any sort of recovery?
Pretty much. Yeah, pretty much. Mm-hmm. Yep. And so they started coming with us, and we started to drop the judgment, because when there's judgment, I'm sorry, but it is really hard to want to help somebody. If you're in a place of judgment, there's little room for love, right?
And
little,
don't you think in your story, the initial education about what addiction is,
yes,
and then that connection with people, those are the two things I find that turn judgment around. When, you know, judgment is almost always a product of being ignorant about something. We judge it. We have these ideas about what something is that we don't understand, like addiction.
Right.
Can you remember, honey, when we were sitting with the boys and we said, just quit.
Yeah.
Just stop. Can't you see
Absolutely.
What this is doing?
Yeah.
We didn't understand the brain.
Yeah. I had that so much in my marriage. My wife would tell me all the time, why can't you just stop?
Right.
Just stop.
Right.
It's that easy. And I would go, sure, stop for me. Yeah. And I go, I tried. Stop for the kids. I tried. I mean, I tried to stop for everybody. It wasn't until I stopped for me that it took hold. You can't stop for somebody else. That's not how this works, in my experience anyways. I mean, you've got to want to stop for yourself. We're going to get back to that in just a second. You're listening to Project Recovery right here. Don't forget, it's a KSL podcast. Hey, welcome back to Project Recovery. We've got Christy and Rick Dixon here, the owners of Renaissance Ranch. They were just telling us a story about how you guys first went to recovery for yourselves to better understand the drug, and then your sons started to go with you.
Yeah.
And what did that look like?
It was a miracle. It really was, because all of the secrets we wanted to learn for many, many years, they started to feel safe and they started to share with us. And in the first meeting they came to, like I said, the addicts are sharing their stories, right? And it's so raw and vulnerable. And it comes around and I thought, oh, there's no way they're gonna share. They both opened up and talked about their history. I mean, things I'd been wanting to hear as a mom for many, many years. It all came out in that meeting. And it's sad that as a parent, like they were telling us how hard it was to stop, but it just wasn't sinking in. Like we just kept thinking it was a choice thing. But in going to the 12-step meetings, you know, and learning and becoming educated, then all of a sudden we were like, whoa, this is really hard. Like this is really hard. And then just really fast forward with our story. We started going to these meetings. The boys started to come into meetings. We were able to get them into treatment, which, you know, by the grace of God, we're so grateful for that. And our church asked us to start now serving. This was like about 15 years ago. asked us to help facilitate these 12-step meetings. So we've been doing that now for 15 years, and we have set in like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of recovery meetings and listen to all of these stories. And then you start to feel all of these patterns of things that are working, and we're like, holy cow, we know now that it is a family illness, that the family members, that they have got to become educated, because if we wouldn't have – we just often ask ourselves, if we would have never – you know, been willing to just go to a meeting and just kind of learn a little bit, I don't think we would have had the outcome, you know, that we've had. So in coming to these meetings, the boys started attending. They started getting into treatment. We were so blessed to be asked to kind of help facilitate meetings. We've been in the jail and the prison. And like I said, hundreds of meetings and hearing thousands of sharing stories. But we know now today that really I really believe the research. I have right here a paper that has over 27, you know, research studies on the importance of having support for our – I now speak as clients, you know, that we own the treatment center. But we do. We see a huge, huge successful outcome when the family members start to learn, you know, kind of their role in all of this, and they heal too from their emotional, spiritual, physical, mental trauma. I really believe there's a lot of trauma, right? But also, they start to speak the same language, and the whole family has this beautiful opportunity to heal. And about 8 years ago, our son was asked to start an outpatient treatment center. So he actually had a relapse after treatment, and that's how we were introduced to Renaissance Ranch about 12 years ago.
So when your sons decided to get help, what did that look like? Were they going willingly, or was it a little persuasion?
Right. Okay, so that's a really good question, because we talk about interventions, right?
Yeah.
And so because we were going to these meetings, we made a lot of friends. And we made a wonderful friend. It's kind of like a sponsor, you know, so to speak. His name was Bob. Oh, wow.
We'll just go with Bob.
Yeah, Bob. He himself had struggled with alcohol for, you know, over 20 years. And he said, you know, I want to come over and share my story with your boys and encourage them. And he kind of was talking about it, doing some type of a gentle intervention. But he said, you, Mom, you have to follow my lead. And I cried and cried and cried, because I felt the Spirit was really trying to teach me, you need to really allow some consequences here, so that these boys can recognize that they really need help. And it's crazy, but with that brain disease, it really trumps that frontal cortex, right? And so they really can't process. Anyway.
Judgment and reason is very poor.
Yeah, it's kind of like, yeah, big time. Addiction has the capacity to take away a person's free agency, take away their will.
So it sounds like you had them come over and tell the story, and there was going to be some consequences. So you guys wanted them to go to a treatment facility.
Right. We needed to get them into some recovery action. And so we kind of framed it like, you know, you're welcome to live here as long as you're willing to do some recovery action. We can support you in your recovery, but we love you too much to support you in your addiction. So if you're welcome, you know, you're welcome to stay here. You know, I hate to say the word kick you out, you know, but he pretty much gave them the homeless shelter's information, gave them our ecclesiastical leader, transient bishop's information and phone number. And we had to kind of do that. He said, Christine, if you don't do something, how many 30-year-old heroin addicts do you hear of living in their parents' basement? He said, this is a chronic, progressive, and fatal disease. And I'm so glad he made me, you know, someone told me you have to think of your son's disease as though they have cancer, you know. And initially when I heard that, I was in that place of judgment. And I was like, ah. But then as I got thinking about it and I learned that this is a true brain disease, I started having this sense of urgency of like, holy cow, if they had cancer, I would totally research the best hospital, the best treatment, the best medication, the best doctor. Why can't I feel like I need to do that? And as we were attending our meetings and becoming educated, then I surely felt that way. I was like, this is not that they are bad and they need to be good. They are sick and they need appropriate help.
And that created a behavior shift where you started approaching this as let's find a solution to the disease,
right?
As opposed to the staying in that judgmental space. So did that lead you to then start researching facilities?
And this was so long ago. It's so funny. I was looking in the Yellow Pages, right? The phone book. Those of you young people, like, we actually had a phone book, right?
And it was old people's Google.
We'll post a picture on Facebook. Yeah.
I'm calling all these treatment centers, and I'm praying my guts out. You know, God, please help me to find the perfect treatment center. And it was cool because I started to get a sense of people who actually had experience with addiction themselves personally. And I had the strongest feeling that they needed to go somewhere where there were a lot of addicts that were staff members, you know. And I could hear
people in recovery.
People in recovery, exactly. And I could hear the compassion and the empathy in their voices. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I called so many centers that eventually I was like, oh, you have personal experience with this, don't you? Because I could feel that empathy, you know. And yeah. And they did. They went into treatment. Well, okay, so the first one, the oldest child, he had struggled longer. So, you know, and I can say his name, Preston and Tyson, you know, because
we're going to have him on the show.
They're going to be on the show. They actually are, you know, one is the CEO today of the ranch and the other is the COO. And they really, truly, they're the ones that are running the show. They're in the trenches with the people with the addiction and we work with the family members. But yeah, Preston was willing to go. He'd had enough.
Would you remember both of them went at the same time and
Preston? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I had to find different treatment centers because when you're using together and they're the same family, treatment centers want to separate them. So mm-hmm. we had two different treatment centers. So the oldest one stayed, the younger one left after one day, right? And then he had a hard row. You know, he had some hard things, really hard things. But those hard things were a blessing because that's the thing that woke him up and helped him to get into treatment. And we honor those boys and Preston especially because he's the one that really got our family into some serious recovery education. And we love that treatment center. They did a great job. Then the younger one eventually Tyson decided to go into treatment. Thankful for his older brother setting that example, you know, and encouraging him. And so he did. He went into treatment. And then he felt like he could hang out with his friends, you know, and all these years, 15 years, we've heard this phrase of terminal uniqueness. Or sometimes, you know, they just have more things to learn. And I tell our family members, don't be afraid of relapse. Sometimes that's a part of the process. And that means that there's something new to learn, something new to learn. So our Tyson had a relapse and then he went to the ranch. But this is what I loved about the ranch, you know, 12 years ago, is that they were big time into family education. And all the research shows today that, it's like I've seen the research I've read is between 68% and 78% higher success rate.
Yeah.
If the family's on the same page, they're learning how to not trigger, they're learning how to not shame. But at the same time, they're learning how to set boundaries and allow consequences. And there's so many things that the codependency from a family perspective that we need to learn to have peace and to grow. And today we celebrate recovery because our marriage is so much stronger. I feel like that was all a blessing because I feel like we had all of this emotional dishonesty. We didn't know how to express our feelings, which then you don't have a lot of healthy intimacy. You don't really have that beautiful frequency in your energy and connection, right? And
well, that's what we say on the podcast here. The opposite of addiction, most people think it's abstinence, but it's not. It's connection.
Meaningful human connection.
Yeah, you need to have that connection. And it sounds like, I mean, that's the takeaway for me right now is that, you know, this recovery has given you your family back. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think it's having generations. Like my dad's dad, my mother's father smoked for 50 years. And my father was in the military. He was in the Vietnam War. And I was kind of raised like, you know, kids are to be seen and not heard. But my parents are great. But you're right. In that generation, they didn't know how to discuss feelings. And I feel like with this generation, we are so blessed because we have all of these resources. We have all this information now to start learning that our emotions and our feelings, they can make us really sick if we don't learn
how to
talk about it.
It's all those dang psychologists telling you to talk about your feelings.
I think. Right?
Absolutely.
Every time I get a text from you, I was like, oh, man, is this going to go somewhere? How do you go from putting a kid into Renaissance Ranch into owning Renaissance Ranch?
You're like, we liked it so much, we'll buy it.
Yeah.
We'll buy that place. Well, we owe a lot to Rick. You need to share the story. Be honest about that. Not honest, but vulnerable.
Be emotionally honest, Rick.
It's a safe place.
Yeah, it's kind of a spiritual experience. As Christy mentioned, we were addiction recovery missionaries and still are. And I'd just gotten out of a meeting that I did, and felt close to the Lord. I was feeling empowered and feeling good about how the meeting went. And you're centered after a meeting, as you know, Casey. You've been there many times. And I got in the car, and on the way home, I felt in my mind and my heart, just out of the blue, you need to buy Renaissance Ranch. And I thought, I was not interested. I had a company at that time. We had over 60 offices nationally, doing well. We were getting ready to sell it. I had no interest in another business at all. And again, you need to purchase a Renaissance Ranch. And that three times I felt that impression. And it was so strong that I said, okay, I'll just call the owner, who I'd never met. But because Tyson had gone to the ranch 4 years or so earlier, 4 or 5 years, something like that earlier, I had talked to him on the phone, but we'd never met. I called him and I said, I don't know if you remember me. My son Tyson went through, but I kind of feel funny about this, but I just felt impressed to call you to see if you had an interest in selling. If not, that's fine. So I really let him get off the hook, you know, because if he says no, I'm good.
Make it easy for him to say no. Yeah.
And long story short, the answer was, well, we probably, you know, ought to talk. And what had happened is that the previous owner had expanded the St. George location was not doing as well. It was financially really draining, and to the point that it drained the funds. And now he was starting to put his own in, and there was some real potential, you know, problems that could be devastating for the company. Long story short, I was able to at that point come in, and we were able to purchase it through some miracles. What's really interesting is that boy who was in jail 13 times, as Christy mentioned, is now the CEO of the ranch. What we learned, it takes an addict to heal an addict. Our other boy, Press, is the COO. Both of them have different talents and abilities. Both are recovering addicts. Both have over 10 years of recovery. Both of them understand emotional dishonesty. Both of them understand addiction, and they understand relapse. And that's what's incredible about this whole story, about the ranch, about our boys. And, you know, I just want to take us back for just a second, because many family members who have maybe addicts or potential addicts that they're wondering about say, how could this happen? We're a good family. And I just want to validate that. Addiction does not matter.
It doesn't discriminate.
It doesn't. But what's really interesting is that many families, family members, parents can contribute to the addiction both, and they can also contribute to the recovery. You know, I look back and I've just been thinking over the last couple minutes, you know, we had a great family. We'd go camping. We did motorcycle riding together, sports together. I mean, yes, we went to church together. We prayed together. I mean, in church, you'd look at us when our family was younger, looking again, and say, man, that's an all-American, good, solid Draper, Utah family. But you know what? Many of the issues that we were having, many other families have. It's just that as family members, we don't realize it. We didn't know about the core center of addiction is shame, and that this is a feelings disease, and addiction is a family feelings disease where we don't want to talk about our feelings. We don't necessarily want to discuss the feelings. We don't want to think about our feelings, and we don't want to feel our feelings. And to ever shut down a person's feelings is to shame them. And that's what I was good at doing, sad to say. I would shut the boys off or the kids and say, no, we're not going there, you know. And I wouldn't let them discuss their feelings because, see, it wasn't okay when I was young. And addiction, there's no fault. There's no judgment. No, there's no blame. We don't blame, and we can't blame ourselves as parents. We can't blame the addict. It is what it is. And this is generational. This is a generational disease. But let me just say this. I am so grateful that addiction came into our family. It sounds strange, but I'm very grateful. Not for the dark abyss and the times of sleepless nights and the stints in jail and wondering if our boys are going to live or die. No, I'm not grateful for that, no. What I'm grateful for is because of addiction, the relationships now that I have with my boys, that I have with my wife, that I have with my other kids and others. Being in recovery on my own, not from drugs or alcohol, but learning the 12 steps, learning emotional honesty, learning these things, learning how to feel and to express those feelings, and where has caused from before when I had zero relationship with the boys and almost none with my wife, now to I trust and have a relationship with my boys, and they are my best friends. I trust them. We're in business together. They run the business. Before, I couldn't trust them in my home. Now with my wife being so upset and thinking that she's doing this way and saying that she needs to leave or the boys leave, to the point, to a couple nights ago, it was two or three nights ago, she says, and we're just her and I, we're I'm standing and she's sitting down at the bar, and she says, can you feel
kitchen. Well, the bar in the kitchen.
Yeah, I should not say the bar in the kitchen, but she says, can you feel the frequency of our marriage? I says, yeah. And it, on a scale of 1 to 10, it's like a 15. I mean, it's what I find with Christian and I that we have, most couples never have. But it's because of recovery and because of our boys' addiction that is together we came as one. And it's a story of tragic and of darkness to a story of not just hope, but a story of miracles. And maybe, honey, you can share a couple other things.
I was going to say, if you don't own a recovery center, you should, because that was powerful.
That was.
I mean, but you said it so eloquently. I mean, it was. Yeah. Because we talked about this last week on about my addiction. I would sit in those 12-step meetings, and people would come up, and they'd be like, I wouldn't wish this disease upon anybody, but I wouldn't change the fact that I got it for the world. And I used to think that is the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
Right.
But now I'm to a place in my recovery that I go, yes, because of this, I'm more empathetic, I'm more loving, I'm more present. And when you just spoke about having a relationship with your kids, I was just like you. I checked all the boxes. We had big birthday parties. We had season passes. We got to go to movies. We did all the stuff. On the outside, people looking in, it's like you're checking the boxes. But I did not have a real connection with my kids because I wasn't present. Mm-hmm. I wasn't with them. I was there, but I wasn't present. Mm-hmm. And because of the recovery now, I have these relationships with my kids, these authentic, genuine, loving relationships. And I am thankful for my recovery for giving me that. So when I talk about my recovery and all the things it's given me, that is what I'm most proud of, is that, you know, for the first time in my life, I like who I am. I'm comfortable with who I am. And I can speak about and I know where I'm going and I know what I want to do. I by no means am I cocky enough to say I've got this figured out, because I don't. But I do know a good direction and I know I'm headed that way.
Oh, I love that. Well, it's really powerful too with our family members, is they come in and we see the look on their faces. And of course we can identify, you know, with that. But they're so, so sad and fearful. Oh yeah. And there's been some devastation. There's maybe been some divorce. A lot of them have lost loved ones to addiction.
Mm-hmm.
But by the end of the first meeting, just the first meeting, by them hearing maybe some stories of some other family members, they start to feel some hope. And last night we had a meeting. They're all online now, which was so nice for people to be able to just hop on. I think we had maybe 35 family members and just a lot of hope. And we had a woman on there, which you might want to have in your podcast someday.
Sure.
But she's going to be starting our women's support education group. And again, these are all free. They're online.
That's Utah's favorite F word.
She's been through
free.
It. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's probably everybody's, yeah. Right? But she's been through a lot. She's had a lot of women's issues unique to her, you know, real severe trauma. And she's going to be great. It's so nice for me, like being at all these 12-step meetings all these years, it's so nice to know the resources are there. It's nice to know that every one of those steps helps you connect with your higher power. You know, we term Heavenly Father and Jesus Christ, but people to find that divine connection that works for them. The founders of AA who came up with these 12 steps said that the foundation of recovery is spiritual. And that's what we've seen. We've heard so many people say, I could not find that long-term sobriety until I found my higher power, or that spiritual connection, that divine connection. And so many people, so many addicts don't necessarily have support, and they struggle. It takes them so much longer. If they do have family members who are willing to become educated and even work, we know for family members that we have to work the same 12 steps. We've got to work through our false beliefs, our prejudice, our discrimination, our anger, our fear, our despair, our hopelessness. We have to have – so I kind of call it the bullseye of healing, because you're working like one-on-one with your Savior or your God, right? And you're working through – you're writing down those answers to those steps. You're figuring out, you know, where have been my blind spots, my character defects and my weaknesses, and you're actually growing and you feel that growth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that at the ranch we're really unique, because we've heard, at least from a lot of other people and other treatment centers we've been involved with too, is that you know, we didn't know that we were supposed to actually, as family members, we didn't know we were supposed to do recovery too. You know, we didn't have that opportunity. And I think because people are feeling so much growth emotionally and spiritually and, you know, all of that through working their own steps, they keep coming. And so just that, like that energy and that growth is so powerful. And it's to me, it's just like the how-to of how to work the gospel of Christ. You know, it's just like the steps, the directions, all the pieces of the recovery puzzle are right there if you're willing to work those steps.
We've often said the 12 steps would be just a good guideline for a lot of people to live their life. And you guys are a 12-step-based treatment center, Renaissance Ranch. If people want to find out more information about you guys and your free programs, where do they go?
Just renaissanceranch.com. But remember to spell Renaissance with two S's and one N.
Okay.
RenaissanceRanch.com. Yeah, and they can get
Does the other one take you to a naughty site?
I don't know. But they'll get the schedule of...
We'll try it later.
Yeah. I was like, I was trying to figure that out in my head. I was like, huh.
RenaissanceRanch.com. It's because I couldn't find it. I couldn't spell it, you know?
I'm not a very good speller.
So, yeah, but no, seriously, it's super cool. Because of this COVID thing, it's been a blessing. We've got, starting next week, we'll have 5 weekly classes every single week.
And then, Rick, real quick, tell me about your podcast. You guys do a podcast, right?
Oh, yes. Family. Yep. It's as simple as Family Addiction Recovery Podcast. We've wanted to reach out somehow for years. I've been working on a book for years, but I'm in grad school, so it'll probably take me forever to get it done. So the podcast is great. We want to blend the voices of the addicted and the family member and a clinician in every podcast and start building that bridge so that the addicted person and their family member can understand each other's perspective. They can have more compassion, empathy, and just open those doors of communication. Because usually when addiction comes to a family, it starts to divide the family and divide those relationships in this big chasm, and you don't know how to get that reconnect going on, right? Mm-hmm. So in this podcast, we're excited to blend both perspectives.
Awesome.
So we can heal as a family.
Hey, thank you guys for stopping by. And this is not the last we're going to hear from you guys, because you got two sons. We're going to get them on the podcast. And, of course, we appreciate you supporting Project Recovery, allowing us to get out an episode every week. Dr. Matt, your thoughts?
Well, I think what a wonderful resource for our listeners and for the community. So I hope people will go online and see how they can benefit from your classes. And it just reminds me of the fact that probably the two most important things that we ever have in this life, we we rarely, if ever, put any study into so we can become experts at them. You know, if you want to be an engineer or an attorney, you put a lot of study into those sorts of things, or a highly skilled radio professional like Casey.
Sure.
But our families, our parenting and our marriages, we just do them. Isn't that too bad? Isn't that backwards?
Yeah, there's
the
no
most
classes,
important things.
No,
right.
Yeah.
Well, there are classes. You can go to Renaissance Ranch to
yeah,
do it.
No, yeah, I mean,
but
yeah.
I mean, the reality is what my takeaway from this is how beautiful your marriage is. I can see it between the two of you, and how beautiful your family relationships must be, because a crisis caused your family to study how can we find the things that we don't do well, like how we communicate and our prejudices and all those things that are happening in all of our families. So I think it's just, hopefully this episode's an inspiration to everyone, including myself, to put a little study into those relationships in our family.
So thank you guys very much. Thank you for stopping by. You've been listening to Project Recovery, a KSL podcast.
Contents of this program are for informational purposes only. The program is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician, licensed therapist, or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard on this program. KSL does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the program. Reliance on any information provided on the program is solely at your own risk.
I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. In October of 1985, a woman named Cherie Warren left work at a busy Salt Lake City office
to meet her estranged husband at a downtown auto dealership.
She never made it home. Cherie's car surfaced weeks later in Las Vegas.
In the parking lot of a hotel casino.
No one knows how it got there.
Strange. It was strange.
Both Cherie's estranged husband and her boyfriend raised suspicion for investigators.
I kind of thought that he might have done something.
But no arrests were ever made. In Cold Season 3, we dig into double lives, make new connections in the case, and examine the difficulty raised by reasonable doubt.
We want answers just as much as anyone else.
They have creeps like that now too, so nothing's changed.
That's the new Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie. Now available anywhere you get your podcasts.